This podcast is shared for the purposes of information only. The discussion does not reflect a direct or implied endorsement by Municipal World or its members.
This podcast is brought to you by Enbridge Gas and the Affordable Multifamily Housing Program. Please visit enbridgegas.com/affordable for more information.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in. For Municipal World, I'm Scott Vokey. This is the NW Shares podcast, where we share the stories of communities from coast to coast to coast. These are the stories of local government, the celebrations of success, the sharing of lessons learned, the cautionary tales, and the keen insights into what lies ahead for municipalities. Hello, and thanks for joining us for another episode of MW Shares. Today I'm being joined by Ian McCormick. Ian is a nationally recognized certified management consultant and the president of Strategic Steps. Since 2000, Ian has worked on strategic development, implementation, revision, and alignment, both as a government employee and as a private sector business advisor. Ian and I are going to be talking about some of the attributes that make a good leader, as captured in his new book, The DNA of Great Leaders, Key Attributes of the Best Mayors and Chairs. Welcome, Ian.
It's very nice to be back after a couple of years having talked to the first book. I'm pleased to be with you.
Well, it's great to be here. And, you know, let's remind people who may not be familiar with you and your work, what interests you the most about municipal politics?
Well, I think in terms of governance rather than politics. So I'm really interested in how well an organization runs and the people who run it. The other reason, local government in particular, a couple of things. For the most part in Canada, of course, we don't have parties. I also think that, again, for the most part, those people who seek the office either succeed or fail based on their own ideas and their willingness to support them. I also hear quite frequently that government moves at a snail's pace or glacial. But if you look at it, to me, local government is the order of government that actually moves the fastest. And so there's the duration between when something is actually proposed and when it actually happens is in a realistic time frame so that the leaders and community can actually see what the effect of the decisions that they're making. And since local government is the only order of government where you actually have to live where you represent, for the most part, those people who are on councils or on local boards are people who are representing their communities. They're not professional politicians. They get involved, they kind of move through the system. I use a metaphor of a string sometimes, and I say that you as a councillor or a mayor or a board chair are somewhat transitory. You have inherited the role from somebody else. You add as much value as you can during the time you're here, and then you pass it on to somebody else. And so, Scott, those are some of the reasons that I kind of like local government or what you call municipal politics more than, say, other orders of government.
Right. I hear you about being, you know, good stewards of the organization. And I think that comes across a lot in, you know, your previous work around governance and who's your first book, Who's Driving the Greater. So why did you write this second book, The DNA of Great Leaders?
It's a bit of a deeper dive, if you like, into kind of the follow-up to Who's Driving the Greater, which was about role clarity. This one is more about an exploration of the role of the chief elected official, whether that's a municipal person or a board, a commission, a society or an association, anything that's a place of a municipal board, a governance board. And for the most part, what I've seen is I interact with, I don't know, thousands of elected officials and hundreds of mayors and dozens of board chair. I've seen things that work and that don't. We've had a chance to support some who want to be better, and we've identified issues when we encounter them. I've met some really great mayors over the years, and some of them are quoted in the book, in fact, too. I really liked the ability to use real-life examples in here, and I was looking for a real depth and breadth of experience that was a little bit different than what I had provided in the greater book. So I was looking for large municipalities. For example, we interviewed the mayor of Regina, or a small one where I interviewed the mayor of the village of Stirling. I was looking for urban municipalities. So the mayor of Stratford is in there, and rural like Sturgeon County. I was also looking for a kind of a juxtaposition of new and old, people who were brand new to the role and those who'd been in it for a while. I was also got interested as I went along too, and this was a bit of follow-up to the greater book, that I was introduced to local government in Australia through that. So I included an Australian mayor in this book too, a woman by the name of Kim O'Keefe. She's the mayor of a city just north of Melbourne, and I was really kind of interested to contrast the local government structures, particularly how they relate to the chief elected official, with Canada and Australia, because, of course, we both evolved from a very similar system. So your question was kind of why this book, and to me it's a bit of a narrower focus than what was in the Who's Driving the Greater book, but really interesting to hear from some real people who are new to the job or who've been in it for a while.
Yeah, I think one of the great things that that does, it really roots, you know, some of the theoretical concepts in the real world practical examples. And as you said, there's a number of great quotes from those mayors and chairs that you interviewed. So, you know, the book talks about 25 aptitudes or characteristics of good leaders. Why did you decide to focus on aptitudes?
Well, first of all, the number 25 is arbitrary. It seemed like a number that was big enough to be thorough, but small enough to maybe still be memorable. And for myself, why I talked about aptitudes is, given my own voting record or my own voting history, I get a little frustrated sometimes with the short-sighted nature of an election campaign. The campaign itself often focuses on transactional issues. If you look at local government, high taxes or noisy dogs or potholes or flooding, that sort of thing. But when I vote, I'm way more interested in what the candidate or the mayor, eventually the board chair, will do when that person is faced with issues that we have no idea about. For example, the most recent councils, for the most part, didn't get elected to have to deal with COVID. They didn't get elected to have to deal with the ups and downs of commodity prices. In my own community, there was an explosion in a parkade that council never ran on the platform of having to deal with. So to me, when I think about aptitudes, it helps me understand the human behind the title. And there's a difference, too, between having respect for the role of mayor or board chair and the respect for the incumbent in that, too. I want to be confident that the person I vote for and who gets elected really acts well on issues that I've got no idea about what they are right now, too. So when I started looking at aptitudes, I started kind of keeping some notes as I was going. And they started to theme into three different streams, and I know we'll talk about that a little bit later. But basically, what I had seen, if you look at the nature versus nurture kind of realm, I saw personal characteristics there, kind of those innate traits that a person has because of who they are and what they've grown up to be. So that's kind of the nature part. There's also people who work through community leadership. So the best elected officials that I've seen, by and large, whether they're the mayors or whether they're a board chair or the president of the Rotary Club, they've grown up with their community and in their community, and they understand it. They know its culture. They know how to get most out of people. They can express a compelling vision. So these are aptitudes that I think can be cultivated over time and then get deeper and more expressive. And if you like, this is kind of that nurture part of the nature-nurture argument. And finally, I think there's a set of aptitudes which perhaps I could have called skills. And those are skills of good governance that really take the best people over the top. Those are the people who know how to get the most out of people. They understand each other's roles. They're face of the community, kind of near and far. So if you look at those three groupings together, those aptitudes are really a decent set of topics that I see in the most effective and the most respective heads of organizations. I do know, though, that some aptitudes have a higher profile than others in any given individual. So to me, anyway, those are the sorts of things that I see and the reason that I chose to focus on this group of aptitudes rather than focusing on, say, a particular topic area that they may be good at or may not be good at.
Right. So let's talk about the first of those three buckets that you identified, the ones that you said were kind of on the nurture side of things. So tell us a little bit about the personal characteristics of good leaders.
So this, to me, I guess people say, is a good leader born or are they made? I think they start out being born, and then they kind of evolve over time. So there's a bit of make in there too. So this section ends up being the longest of the book. I think there's 10 aptitudes in here. And just the way they're structured, so I don't scare people with that number, Who's Driving the Greater book, chapters are fairly short, and I've got a few questions for reflection at the end of each of the chapter. Anyway, about the personal characteristics, things like, I think confidence in a crisis is really important. And I made an oblique reference to that before. As the head of the municipality or the organization, I think it's critical that the leader appears to be in charge. That has to be the person who shows that he or she's representing the interests of whatever constituency they are supposed to be representing. And I see that sometimes by looking at the opposite. Sometimes I see a leader who is more interested in representing another entity to citizens rather than representing citizens to whatever the entity happens to be. And that comes off more like risk management than leadership. Another aptitude I'd point out is about keeping ego in check. I spoke a little bit about ego in the greater book, but first of all, I think there is a role for ego in leadership roles. It's necessary for you to believe you got good ideas and you got to be willing to put them forward. It's also important, however, to mitigate that a little bit, that the team is involved and that the mayor or the chair doesn't always have to be the smartest person in the room on every topic. That person knows how to build a team, and keeping an ego in check is a pretty good way of doing that. So the third one I'd point out maybe within this section is about reflection. And I've suggested that reflecting often is something that the best leaders do, because it can be lonely at the top. I understand that. I've been told that many times. And sometimes, who knows, sometimes the boss needs a boss, someone to check in with, even if it's themselves. If they can take the time to think about what's important, if they can be quiet and reflect, if they can get away from the rush, what this does then is allows that leader to get their head up, to look around, and to focus on the strategic stuff, that kind of direction. And to me, that's really what the role of the mayor or chair really is.
You know, the second category deals with community leadership. And I want to single out one aptitude here, because I think it's really particularly relevant these days in such acrimony, you know, clouds a lot of the public discourse. And that's the ability to seek out contrary opinions. Why is this so important?
Well, and to me, there's a big difference between contrary opinions and contrary people or contrarians. But anyway, this chapter you've referenced focusing on contrary opinions is one half a dozen in this particular section of the book. And I would suggest that according to the manuals or the acts that we see, once a decision gets made by a council or a governance board, it becomes that board's decision as a whole, whether it was done unanimously or whether it was done in a split vote, and everybody's supposed to support it after the fact. And to get to that point, you need to get through options and explore those options to have a robust discussion. Heading down that particular direction or that particular road without looking at those options results in decisions that probably aren't the best for the long-term benefit of the community. And so when I talk about those contrary opinions, I'm looking for people who think slightly differently, who take a different fork in the road, not necessarily the yeah buts, but maybe the yeah ands here, because that I think gives the best chance for a rich debate, and that will provide a solid decision. And the caveat to this maybe, that this is for complex decisions, not straightforward ones. You don't need a contrary opinion on whether you're going to approve the minutes or the agenda or take a recess. But if there's a controversial development proposal that's coming before a council, those are the kind of places you want to have that good, solid, robust debate that explores various types and sides of the argument. Well, there's an image in the book that I called a good decision curve. And it suggests that whether you're for or against a topic, you can have some real good debate in a space that there's collaboration, where you kind of share values or principles. But as you start moving further and further away from that mean or the norm, if you say, the debate or the argument becomes less rational, and it's harder to actually include those people. And this is where I often hear words like common sense being bandied around, either for or against a topic. And my working definition of common sense just means people who agree with me. If they don't agree with me, obviously that means they don't have common sense. But to me, that's about how you deal with leadership and dealing with contrary opinions to bring them all together to make the best decisions in the long-term benefit of the community.
The third category deals with governing skills. And one aptitude of this group is to never tolerate abuse of colleagues and staff. You know, we hear this a lot from our elementary schools all the way now up to municipal councils. So I guess one of the questions people may have is, how do strong leaders actually implement this?
Well, first of all, I need to agree with you. This is something that we see, hear, experience way too often. And it's, of all the topics in the book, this is perhaps the most troubling one that we deal with. And unfortunately, as I've said, it's one of the most common ones. We hear the term bullying typically because somebody's bullying me rather than I'm doing it to somebody else. And it's about interactions. Even just this morning, I was reading a newspaper article about where the mayor of Calgary made the news for exactly this reason, because some people were ostensibly doing things that were bullying in nature to her. It's about abuse, if you want to get really down to it, sometimes physical abuse. More often, it things like mental or emotional or social abuse, but it is really restricting that look for the contrary opinions, perhaps, that we just talked to. So in terms of how the leader deals with this, the chair or the mayor, whatever, have the rules, abide by the rules, know the rules that are in place, demand that of others too, call them out good and early when behavior is not meeting expectations. That could be a council colleague, or it could be somebody in the gallery in a public setting. It may even be a member of the public. For a council, though, or a board, if you have a common understanding of those expectations before anything starts to go wrong, it's a good way to start. So things like early on in a term, the thorough review of a code of conduct or a code of ethics, the creation of a covenant amongst members of council or between council and their staff person about expected behavior. Team building and training, that sort of thing, I think can all kind of work towards this and needs to be sponsored by the head of the organization. Something peculiar over the last few years, and one of the reasons I think we may have seen this grow, is COVID, actually. More virtual meetings haven't helped. We see each other through the box of a TV screen or a computer monitor, but we don't really know each other as people, about their humanity and their aptitudes and their likes and their families. We see them as an entity rather than a person, not as a team member. So that, I think, almost dehumanizes them and makes it easier to have some of those bullying behaviors happen. If you look at procedure bylaws or other rules, if you even default back to things like rules of order from Roberts or somebody else, there are things like points of privilege, which a mayor could use or a chair could use or any member of a group could use too, that very rarely happen. I also see the best mayors and chairs understanding when there's a need for external advice and direction. Now, that could be a lawyer in some cases. It could be an integrity commissioner. Maybe it's just an expert in whatever the topic area happens to be that can come and present to council, to staff, and maybe to volunteers too. I've been called in a few times to do that and provide an oversight piece or an overview piece, even to groups of citizens. So to me, there's a lot to this. In fact, even internally, we've noticed it more and more, to the point where some of our folks are starting to pull resources together to think about, how do we manage this? How do we present something to municipalities externally so that they know they're not alone in this as well?
Here in central Canada, where our office is, we're certainly seeing a lot more of that and a lot more use of integrity commissioners. So it'd be great if there was some preemptive actions ahead of time before it got to that, because we're actually seeing, in some instances, the office of the integrity commissioners being kind of weaponized against other councillors.
I hear the term weaponization a lot, and whether it's weaponization of legislation or of various offices. One of the interesting things about Ontario is the use of integrity commissioners, which isn't particularly common across the country. So that formality of someone external who is in an oversight role or an advisory role is not something that is common across the country.
Yeah, and I guess the juries are still out on whether or not it's a good thing. Time will tell. So Ian, the last question I have for you is, obviously, with the exception of your own book, what we've just been talking about, what is the best book that you've read recently?
Should I put in a plug for Municipal World magazine here? because that's nice, because it's digestible and comes out pretty regularly. It's also full of people that I respect and work with. So that's kind of neat anyhow. So I like the columnist. I mean, George Cuff has been a mentor of mine pretty much since day one. I work with Dawn McCoy, who's one of your HR people, and she and I are working together at the moment. Even Anne Mitchell, who's the CIO of Lethbridge County, I had a chance to do her council orientation last fall. So a lot of those people actually I know as people rather than just authors. So I really enjoy that. Anyway, for actual books, a couple for you. One of my colleagues, a woman by the name of Deanna Lennox, wrote a book about her experience. She spent 16 years in the RCMP. Then she was on the city of Fort Saskatchewan City Council. Through this book, she juxtaposes her experience in the RCMP with a love and learning from horses. It's called Damage Done, and really, I couldn't put it down. It's not a municipal governance book per se, but it was something I found really interesting from the human perspective and the human condition. Another one I'm reading is a book called Chatter, and it's about calming voices in our heads. My leadership coach actually gave it to me as something to consider about how to focus for myself, about what's important and how to winnow out some of that wheat from the chaff. I've known, as I do my writing or I run my company, I'm being pulled in more and more directions, and I'm trying to figure out how to put my all into whatever has to be done. So looking for some of that inner calm that so many of us seem to be seeking these days.
Ian, thanks for that. And thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with us today.
You're welcome. That was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
The book is titled The DNA of Great Leaders, Key Attributes of the Best Mayors and Chairs. You can order it and many other great titles from our bookshop at municipalworld.com. Thanks to all of you for listening. On behalf of Municipal World, I wish you peace and purpose.
We'd like to hear your ideas. If you have a topic that you would like to see covered in a future episode, simply drop us an email at stories@municipalworld.com. Also, don't forget to share and subscribe.